This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Trevor Noah, took over The Daily Show from Jon Stewart last fall, and he brings an international perspective to the show. He's South African, the son of a black mother and white father whose relationship was illegal under apartheid, which mandated separation of the races. Noah grew up during the apartheid and post-apartheid eras. He became famous in South Africa as a comic and TV personality and spent years traveling around the world doing stand-up. Terry spoke with Noah last Thursday and began with what may be the best-known segment he's done so far on The Daily Show. This is from last October when he was comparing Donald Trump's rhetoric with statements made by African presidents and dictators.
What I'm trying to say is Donald Trump is presidential. He just happens to be running on the wrong continent. In fact, once you realize that Trump is basically the perfect African president, you start to notice the similarities everywhere, like the level of self-regard.
I say not in a braggadocious way. I've made billions and billions of dollars.
I made a tremendous amount of money. I'm really rich.
I have a great temperament.
They love me anyway. I don't have to do this.
I've done an amazing job.
I was born with a certain intellect. God helped me by giving me a certain brain.
I bet that's the one time that God's like, I don't need the praise. It's cool. That's you. That's you. I'm cool. Now, is that extraordinary level of bragging presidential? Well, let's ask a man who actually was president. Idi Amin, former president and best president of Uganda.
The people likes me very much. I am very popular.
I am very powerful. I am the one who has got the money.
I have got a very good brain.
I have a very good brain. And I know this because every time I ask people if I have a good brain, they say, of course, Mr. President. Now, please let my family go. You've already killed my sister. I think you've proved your point.
That's Trevor Noah on The Daily Show. Trevor Noah, welcome to Fresh Air. Thanks so much for coming. Had you seen The Daily Show in South Africa?
Yeah, but interestingly enough, when I first started watching The Daily Show, we used to see it on CNN. And so my perception of The Daily Show was very different. I thought that Jon Stewart was a news anchor who didn't take his job seriously, because I would always see the
show. You're kidding, right?
I know, I'm being serious. In a lot of regions, CNN actually broadcasts The Daily Show. So there's a global edition of The Daily Show that's one episode. And in countries where there's no Comedy Central or the show itself is not picked up, it'll be on CNN. And because it looked like a news show and it had the same colors as CNN and the ticker, and I just worked under the assumption that it was part of the news programming. And so I was just like, this is a really funny show. And that's how I knew it.
So what is your role now in writing and editing the show?
From 8 a.m. in the morning, we start dissecting the news, discussing it, looking for angles, looking for takes, building a show, rewriting it, getting it together, gathering materials. We work throughout the day, and then in the evening, after we've rehearsed it and rewritten it, then I go out and we tape the show. And then after that taping, we sit down and we dissect the show, see what could be better, work to get better every single day. Because that's really the nature of a late-night show, especially something that's on daily, is that you're on daily. So, you know, it's not unlike the news, funny enough. I was chatting to Rachel Maddow about it, and she was saying, "You the quickest thing you have to learn is your best show only lasts for a night and your worst show only lasts for a night. And then you're back doing it tomorrow."
That leads to manic depression, doesn't it? Look, a show's great and you feel great, and a show's bad and it's like, oh, this is so horrible.
Yeah, that's why you have to learn to live outside the show. I think one of the biggest things I've had to learn is TV destroys your perspective. You know, when I think back to myself and I go, if anyone who tries to convince me otherwise, I have to stop sometimes and go, not what, 25 years ago, I was living in basically a very elevated hut with no running water or indoor sanitation. And so, like, problems, I can't trick myself into getting stressed by first world problems. Things are going great. Things are going very, very well.
Does John watch The Daily Show now, and does he give you feedback on it?
He does, but he doesn't. He gives me feedback sporadically because he knows better than anyone that the thing is happening. You know, it takes such a long time for it's like It's like captaining a giant ship. You make a change and you still have to wait to see that change happen. It's not a nimble speedboat. So John and I, if anything, we spend more time talking about stand-up comedy and the pigs on his farm and just the randomness in our lives. Because, you know, if anything, we were friends before we were linked through this behemoth that is The Daily Show. So that's what we spend time talking about. But he's always there if I need him. But I also try not to need him too much because then I won't find or learn these things myself.
How did you become friends?
Just he reached out to me many, many years ago. He saw my comedy. He said, I'd like to meet you. And then we met. And then John and I just, you know, we just connected. And we hung out, and we have a similar view on the world, but we come at it from different perspectives, obviously. So we just, you know, we just get along really well, and that was something that progressed over time.
So you were briefly a contributor to The Daily Show before becoming the host. Were you friends before becoming a contributor?
Yeah. The contributor thing happened because we got along. John asked me to come to the show and hang out and just see how he does what he does. And we had so much fun, you know, just off camera, that John was like, hey, we should do this on screen. Let's chat about this thing on screen. And so we did that. And then we'd have another conversation. And John would go, hey, we should do that on camera. So he'd go, next time you're in America, let's hang out and let's come to the show and let's do another chat. And so that's all it was, you know. It was never me aspiring to that position. It was never me aspiring to The Daily Show. It was just me being me and then hanging out with my friend John.
Nice. So in your stand-up comedy, you've talked about being excited about coming to America where you would be defined as black instead of, I don't know, colored or mixed race in South Africa because your father is white, your mother is black. And you were born during the apartheid era. So you did some comedy in the U.S. about opening a bank account in America and having to fill out your race or ethnicity, and you don't really know what to write in. And a bank representative is helping you fill out the form. So this is Trevor Noah from his 2013 album, African American.
She was really helpful. She was like, she's this blonde woman, and she was like, yeah, you can go ahead and fill out everything you need to, and yeah, we'll just go ahead and open that bank account. I said, okay, I don't know what to do here. And she was like, let me have a look. Well, you just go ahead and tick whatever race you want to go with. I said, what do you mean, whatever race? She was like, well, look, it's just for statistical purposes, so, like, you can choose whatever you want, and then you can do it. And I was like, choose whatever? I was like, I've never been given that option before. And I looked at the boxes, and I mean, there was black. That's the reason I came. The black box was there. I was like, well, that's it. I'll choose it. But then I looked to the left and there was the white box. And oh, it looked good. It just, I mean, don't get me wrong. It was the same as the other boxes, but there must have been a reason it was first in line. It's just like, you know, that was prime box right there. That was just, I looked at that white box and I was like, yeah. Yeah, and so I looked at her and I said, any box? And she was like, yeah, any box. And I played it safe. I said, so I can go with black? She was like, you know what? A lot of them choose black. Yeah. And so just because she said that, I looked at her and I said, no, you know what? I'm white. I'm going with white. And then she did this thing that I've come to learn as the reaction of white liberal women in America. Whenever they hear something or see something that they can't truly comprehend, they don't agree with it, but for fear of being judged, they internalize their emotions. And then they almost have like this malfunction, like a robot. I don't know if it's amazing to see. Because as soon as I said white, I said, I'm going with white. She went, I'm sorry, did you say white? I said, yes, white. I'm white. She was like, like white?
That was Trevor Noah in 2013. So what was the difference between how you were defined officially, racially in South Africa and in the U.S.?
Well, obviously, because of our history, everybody was divided into a subgroup. You know, so the minutiae of race was really scrutinized in South Africa. So because my mother is black and my father is white, I was classified as colored. And which is strange, because that means technically, according to the law at the time, my mother, my father, and myself all had different privileges according to the law and would be treated differently, you know, if we were arrested or defined what schools we could go to, what areas we could live in. So, yeah, so that was, I mean, that's always something that I mess around with, because it's all a ludicrous system, you know. I mean, a lot of people were hurt during that time, but you also have to acknowledge how crazy and ludicrous it was.
So were you taken aback when you realized you're no longer in apartheid South Africa, but you have to write down what your race is?
Oh, yeah. But I think I was more surprised by the fact that you can choose whichever one you want, which is which is entertaining to me. I always tell my friends, I'm like, why doesn't everyone just tick white? Just tick white and see what happens in the system. What's the worst that could happen?
Racial identity is a big part of your comedy when you're doing stand-up. Your father is white. Your mother is black. Your father is, I think, of Swiss and German ancestry. Do I have that right?
Yeah, he's Swiss. Swiss.
And your mother is Xhosa?
Xhosa.
Thank you. I don't think I can do that. And I know your mother was jailed briefly, I hope, in South Africa, I assume, for opposing apartheid, for doing some kind of dissenting action.
Yes, well, the dissenting action was being with a white person.
Oh, that's why she was jailed?
Yes.
The white person your father?
Yes, he was, yeah.
Was he jailed for it, too?
No. White people didn't get jailed for that. That was white people were warned and asked not to do it again. But then if you were a black person caught fraternizing across color boundaries, then you'd be arrested. But my mom opposed the system as a whole. So she never let that stand in her way, you know, and I think I pick up a lot of, I have a lot of my mom's demeanor, is that she never even when she told me the story, she was never angry. She just went, it's a stupid thing, and so I refused to listen to it. But she never came at it from a place of anger. If anything, she defied it, and she didn't give it the credibility that it was trying to create in the world. And so that's something that I inherited from my mom, is that in my family, we're not quick to anger. If anything, you know, I mean, obviously, there are moments where you find things ridiculous or ludicrous, but not quick to anger. Rather find a way to laugh about it or to minimize it using humor.
Were you born yet when she was jailed?
Yeah, I was.
How old were you?
I was everything from 3 years old all the way through to 6 years old.
She was jailed for 3 years?
No. I'm saying during that time period. No. She was jailed for a month here and there, and then like for a weekend, and then for a week, and so on.
So they couldn't live together. Where did they live, and where did you live?
Well, I lived with my mom. So the way it works in South Africa is you were allowed to downgrade. So, you know, you could almost forfeit your rights and then go live in an area that was deemed inferior to the one that you're allowed to live in. So I was living with my mother in Soweto and my grandmother and the rest of our family. And then my father lived, he lived in the city center. And so I guess there were times when my mom would sneak us in to go meet and hang out as a family when we could. But for the most part, that's where I spent most of my time.
After your parents separated, your mother married a man who became the father of your two brothers. You've described him as becoming alcoholic and abusive. Did he abuse you?
No. My mom was very protective of me, so I didn't suffer, you know, much of that. But I mean, a home that is terrorized by an abusive drunk is terrorized all the same. You know, I feel like we were all in the same boats, because we were. But physically, I was spared much of that torment.
And what did he hit her?
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, it's widely documented, and it's something my mom raised me not to be ashamed to speak about, because that was always the biggest thing she said, was we live in a world where, for some strange reason, women are taught to be ashamed of the fact that they have been abused, and then the victims are running around with the shame, whereas we should be shaming those who are the abusers. So yeah, so he hit my mom, and you know, and that was the craziest thing, is you're living in a world where it happens sporadically, like, you know, it wasn't an everyday thing, but it was once is enough, you know. But it was a very harrowing experience to go through. And so, you know, the combination of the alcohol and a bad temper led to that environment.
She left him and then went with another man. And when he found out about this other man, after he and your mother were divorced, he shot her twice.
Yeah, well, my mom didn't leave to go to another man. So my mom completely left the home, moved out with my brothers. I was already out of the home at that time. Mm-hmm. And she went and set up a new life. And then at that point, one day they came home from church, and then he pitched up, and he was drunk, and then he threatened to kill the whole family, including himself. And then he shot my mom twice.
In the face and in the back?
Yep, that's correct.
But she survived.
She did. She did.
What kind of shape is she in now? Did she have a full recovery?
Oh yeah, my mom is a soldier, and now, I mean, now we joke that she's bulletproof, because it was, I mean, it really was a miracle, and the doctors hated using that term, and they were the ones who said it, you know. My mom is deeply, deeply religious, and her and I have always fought about religion over the years. I challenge her on it, and she completely immerses herself in it. But then, I mean, when someone gets shot in the head and suffers no brain damage and is alive and needs to go through no surgery and a bullet completely passes through the head, then you almost have to concede. I mean, who was I to say I don't believe in miracles when I've seen this happen in my life? So you know, we laughed about it, we joked. I mean, that's really the hallmark of my family is, I mean, a few days afterwards in the hospital, my mom was the person who cracked the first joke. You know, I was crying by her bedside, and she said to me, she said, "Don't cry, look on the bright side." She said, "Now you're officially the best looking person in the family." So, you know, so we've, you know, we've overcome a lot because of laughter. I think that's why I love comedy so much. It's because it's the thing that has kept my family going through every single type of adversity.
So when you started performing in America, did you have to learn where the landmines were, where the things were, where if you said something about it, people would be offended?
Yes, definitely.
So what was that process like of not realizing that things would be interpreted in a way that you didn't mean?
It's a process of trial and error. You work through the material, you talk to the people. It also helps to live here, you know, which is something I could only do with time. So, for instance, in America, there's a huge sensitivity around fat, right? If you say somebody's fat, or if you say, because there's been a culture of fat shaming, and you know, there's clearly an epidemic. I mean, partly because of the food and just because of the lifestyles and so on, that this is now no longer being seen as like a choice thing anymore. Whereas where I'm from, you would be teased more for being skinny. You know, fat and thin were two sides of the same coin. It was never something that could be held over anyone. So it doesn't hold the same, like, it's not judged as much. It's just a statement of a fact. That's what people go. They go, that person is fat, that person is too thin. And then you get laughed at regardless. It was just like a thing that you can play with. The same goes for national pride in America. And obviously I understand because of, you know, the wars that were waged, and post 9/11, I guess it increased tenfold. The national pride is very different. So if you go to the UK and you insult the British or the British identity, they're very open to that, because as a culture and as a society, they've gone, hey, we have a history of destroying the world, and we colonized the world, and I guess they've worked through a lot of that, and the way they see themselves is in a very self-deprecating way. Still proud to be British, but they allow those jabs a lot more. Whereas in the US, you have to be very careful as to how you speak about America to Americans, because a lot of people have been told, and you see it every day on the news, that America is under attack. And so people have this culture of, we need to defend ourselves. And so these are small landmines that you pick up as you go from one place to the next. You go, okay, this is sensitive here, but it's not sensitive there. This is a thing that's an issue here, but it's not an issue there.
In terms of the fat example, I think you might be referring to a tweet that you sent that was criticized. You had retweeted, when a woman is loved correctly, she becomes 10 times the woman she was before. And then you added, so she gets fat? That was in 2014. Were you surprised at the response to that?
Oh, no, I'm not surprised by the response to any comedy taken out of context. Comedy is all about context. If you think about the things you say to your friends or to people you know, if a stranger hears them, they would think you're the most horrible human being in the world, you know? When you know someone, that's when it becomes comedy. That's exactly what comedy is. It's a familiarity that is combined with you breaking down a commonly held, a commonly held belief. So I mean, what was ironic about that tweet that you're reading is that was me and my girlfriend at the time. Like, that's something that no one even bothered to check. You go, who was he messaging? I was speaking to my girlfriend at the time in public. And that was, we were both fat at the time. We had gained a lot of weight. We were both happy. We were both lazy. And so we were joking about it. But people don't bother. They go, oh, you were fat shaming a stranger on the internet. And you're like, this is not a stranger. This is somebody I live with and somebody that I love. So, but any conversation taken out of context is, these are things that I know about comedy. That's why comedy has existed for so long in a safe space, and that is in a comedy club, you know. But with the change in social media and sharing and videos and so on and sound bites, we now live in a world where people are part of conversations that they originally weren't, really. So you're now overhearing everything that everybody's talking about, and you're not part of the conversation.
Well, Trevor Noah, thank you so much for talking with us. I wish you good luck with The Daily Show. I've been enjoying it very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Trevor Noah is the host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. He spoke with Terry last Thursday. Paul Westerberg of The Replacements and the singer-songwriter Juliana Hatfield have a new collaboration called The I Don't Cares. Our rock critic Ken Tucker says their new album, Wild Stab, is both disciplined and unruly.
The songs on Wild Stab reach out and grab you. They're built around the kind of rootsy rock and roll that Paul Westerberg has been making for a long time now. Music he originally made in part to connect with an earlier generation of rockers like the Rolling Stones, the Faces, and the Kinks. Juliana Hatfield sounds very good singing alongside him. Her own past as a member of groups such as Blake Babies, the Lemonheads, and the Juliana Hatfield 3 has positioned her as both a leader and collaborator. Together, they fall into an easy rhythm with each other. The name Westerberg and Hatfield have chosen, the I Don't Cares, is a definite signal for the way they want you to come to this music. The duo is trying to keep expectations low, to create the experience of musicians tossing off sounds, playing with guitar riffs and chorus hooks. It's supposed to hit your ears like garage rock, like basement tapes, dusted off and tidied up, but not too much. We'll be right back. As Westerberg and Hatfield tell it, Westerberg had a bunch of songs and wanted a fresh pair of ears to listen to them, letting Hatfield suggest what songs might work together as an album. He's described her as the album's de facto executive producer, and that they called each other Sandpaper and Daffodil for the contrast of their voices. It's a contrast that yields moments of very pretty, romantic pop.
We'll give our lips something to do. Give our mouth some words to say. Fill our hands, there's work to do. Just in case they want to stray. We're all business, you and I. Professional as we can be. Hurry up, it's nearly five. We're all right, it's only three. Hey, let's take a kiss and break. Listen to our body clock. We've been at this thing all day. Baby, what's to say? Take a kiss and break.
Most of the songs on Wild Stab run between 2 to 3 minutes, with one big exception. Hands Together, a 6 minutes-plus mini-epic about love and loneliness that features the album's most carefully arranged wordplay and structure.
I attended Ty Cobb's funeral and managed to find a seat. Then I went out dancing with Miss Garbo. Tried my best to not step on her feet.
While Hands Together is this album's most conventionally ambitious song, I can't say that it's anywhere near my favorite. I much prefer the looser, shambling songs that bash you over the head with a happy slap. The I Don't Cares come along at a time when Westerberg has finished up a reunion tour with his career-making band, The Replacements. And this new album feels in part like a winding down, a tension release from the burden of having to make good on the demands of longtime fan loyalty. It sounds to me as though Westerberg and Hatfield sought the refuge of the I Don't Cares to relax while also being productive. The result is music that's never a stab in the back, but a stab to the heart. And the hurt feels awfully good.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed the new album Wild Stab by the I Don't Cares. Coming up, business reporter Tom Wainwright compares the business models of big box stores and franchises to those of Mexican drug cartels. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. What do drug cartels have in common with Walmart and McDonald's? Journalist Tom Wainwright discovered that the cartels' business models have several things in common with the strategies of big box stores and fast food franchises. He learned that and more when he decided to cover the global drug industry as if it were like any other business. He describes his new book, Narconomics, as a business manual for drug lords, and also a blueprint for how to defeat them. He describes himself as a not very brave business journalist who's covered the most exotic and brutal industry on earth. He became the Mexico correspondent for The Economist in 2010 and spent the next 3 years covering that country as well as parts of Central and South America. He's now the Britain editor for The Economist. He spoke with Terry last Monday.
Tom Wainwright, welcome to Fresh Air. So one of the comparisons you make is between the narco supply chain and the Walmart supply chain. Make that comparison for us.
Well, it sounds kind of outrageous, but the reason that I got to thinking about this was that I was looking at the supply chain of cocaine. I went down to Bolivia and I went to visit some of the terraces down there in the Andes where the coca leaf is grown. It's that the coca leaf is the raw ingredient for cocaine, and all of the world's cocaine is grown down there in the Andes in either Bolivia, Colombia, or Peru. And so I went down there and I read about all the incredible work that's been done down there to try to disrupt the cocaine supply line. And you'll have seen footage probably of aeroplanes and helicopters dumping tons of weed killer on these Andean terraces in Colombia, for instance. And they've done lots of work on this, and they've done a fairly effective job of making it harder to grow coca leaf. They destroyed hundreds of thousands of hectares over the years, and it's made the lives of cartels more difficult, on the surface at least. And yet I looked at the price of cocaine in the United States and it's hardly budged. You can go back decades and, you know, the price has remained at roughly $100 per pure gram.
And part of the rationale for destroying the crops is that it drives up the price of the coca leaves, therefore driving up the price of drugs, therefore making it less affordable for people, therefore being effective in the war on drugs. Do I have that right?
Well, that's the idea. Yeah, that's the idea, at least. Right. An economist would assume that if you cut supply, as you say, then the price will go up, other things being equal. And yet this hasn't happened. So I was kind of intrigued by this. It seemed like a puzzle. And I looked into it, and it turns out that if you compare areas in Colombia, for instance, where crop eradication has gone on with areas where it hasn't, the price of coca leaf, the wholesale price of coca leaf, doesn't really change. And the theory is that the cartels in the area have what economists call a monopsony. So that's like a monopoly on buying in the area. In other words, they're the only ones who buy the product in the area. And this rang a bell with me because it's something that people very often say about Walmart. They say that in certain industries, Walmart is effectively the only buyer in the industry. And so if there's some disruption to supply, let's say the harvest fails for apples or something like that, apple growers aren't able to increase their prices because Walmart is the only buyer, and they say, well, sorry, but this is our price, and if you don't want to sell to us, well, tough. And so the sellers have to carry on selling at the same price as before. And it seemed that something similar might be going on in the cocaine industry, and sure enough, the cartels that buy the drug are the monopsony buyers, the only buyers in each area.
So the cartels aren't, like, learning from Walmart. It's just that that's the way both Walmart and the cartels operate.
Yeah, that's right. I don't think there's a kind of conscious decision where the cartels have gone out there and thought, hey, let's be exactly like Walmart. But it helps to explain why this strategy, which on the surface, as I say, looks quite effective. You know, governments have been able to disrupt the supply of coca leaf quite well. It helps to explain why it actually has had very little effect on the price. And I mean, that's not the only reason. When you look at the economics of this supply chain, you begin to see why, actually, even if you could increase the price of that coca leaf, it's doubtful that it would have very much impact on the final price of cocaine in the US or in Europe. Because to make, for instance, a kilo of cocaine, you need about a ton of coca leaf. And that ton, once it's all dried out, in a country like Colombia, it will fetch perhaps $400. Now, the kilo of cocaine in the United States will fetch about $100,000. And so if you, let's say you're incredibly successful in managing to raise the price of coca leaf and you manage to double it to $800, if you then manage to transfer all of that extra cost onto the consumer, that final kilo of cocaine is only going to cost now $100,400. In other words, you can double the price of coca leaf and you increase the price of the final product, cocaine, by less than 1%. And I sometimes say it's a bit like, imagine if you were trying to increase the price of artwork and you decided that you would do this by driving up the cost of paint. You know, you wouldn't expect it to have a very big effect because the cost of paint is such a tiny, tiny part of the overall price of the finished product. It's just the same with cocaine. We're putting all this effort into raising the price of coca leaf when, in fact, that's only a small part of the cost of the final product.
In keeping with the theme of how cartels compare to legit businesses and how they operate, franchising. Like some of the cartels franchise, you compare them to McDonald's in this respect. And an example that you give is the Zetas. So who are the Zetas and how did they franchise the brand?
Well, the Zetas are one of Mexico's biggest drug cartels, and they've got a reputation for being one of the nastiest ones. When you see pictures of people who've been beheaded or hung up from bridges, you know, these are often the guys who are responsible. And while I was in Mexico, the Zetas expanded more quickly than any other cartel. It was extraordinary. They originally came from the northeast of Mexico, but within a very short space of time, they spread across all of Mexico and, in fact, down into Central America as well. And so I got thinking about how they'd done this. And when you look at the way that they spread, it seems that what they do is that they go to local areas and they find out who the local criminals are, the people who do the drug dealing and the extortion and all the other kinds of crime. And they offer them a deal. They say, OK, you can use our brand. You can call yourselves the Zetas, just like us. And they give them, believe it or not, baseball caps with embroidered logos. And they give them T-shirts with their logo on. And they train them in how to use weapons sometimes. And in return, the local criminals give the Zetas a share of all the money that they get from their criminal activities. So, in other words, it's exactly like the kind of franchising model that many other well-known companies use. And it comes with all the same advantages and disadvantages. I mean, one of the big advantages is that it's allowed the Zetas to grow much more quickly. One of the disadvantages, though, and this is something that you often see in the legitimate franchising business, is that the franchisees often start to quarrel among each other. And the trouble is that the interests of these franchisees, the local criminals, aren't very well aligned with the interests of the main company. Because as far as the main company is concerned, and this applies whether it's the Zetas or McDonald's, if you've got more branches, more franchises in a local area, that means more income for the main company because they take their money as a slice of the income of the local franchisees. But the local franchisees have totally different motives. They want to be, if possible, the only ones in the area. They want as few branches as possible. And so you've had very often cases of franchisees suing the main brand over what they call encroachment. In other words, when the main brand has too many branches in the same area.
So just to back up a bit, you mentioned, so like with the Zetas, that they gave out, what, like T-shirts and hats with their logo on it, with like the Zeta, the Zeta name or the Zeta logo. I mean, the Zetas are a drug cartel. Is it really okay to be walking around with their logo on your T-shirt? Doesn't that kind of get in the face of the police?
You'd think it might, wouldn't you? Yeah, I mean, it depends where you are. I think in some parts of Mexico, that would be a problem. I mean, not all of Mexico is quite as chaotic as what you see on the news. And certainly, if you walk around Mexico City, it's much like walking around a city in, you know, in the United States or in Europe, or at least in the kind of rich, very center of the town. But in other bits of Mexico, that's not the case. I mean, you can sometimes on sale in local markets in cities, including indeed actually on the edge of Mexico City, you can see pirate DVDs for sale, which have the Zeta brand on them. It's like Zeta, I should say, in Spanish, just means the letter Z or Z, as we say in Britain. And people in northern Mexico even complain that sometimes if you go to a bar, you'll find bottles of whiskey which have this letter Z on them because the cartel, the Zetas, have got into all of these different types of business. And really, like any other big business, like any multinational, they're starting to diversify because they found that although there's plenty of money to be had in drugs, you know, there are lots of other opportunities out there.
You're right that cocaine starts to become really valuable a little further down the supply chain, not where their coca leaves are grown, but further down the supply chain at the U.S. border. It's probably an obvious question, but why is that an important place in the supply chain?
Well, it's a really good question, actually, because I think very often when we're reporting on the drug war, people forget that the drug changes value as it moves down this supply chain. And very often you see these stories where the DEA or the Mexican authorities intercept a large quantity of drugs, and it's reported that these drugs have a street value of however many million dollars. But often when you look more closely at how much these drugs are worth, you get a slightly different kind of number and it looks rather less impressive. And just to give one example, when I arrived in Mexico, soon after I got there, there was this incredible finding in Tijuana where the Mexican police found this amazing stash of marijuana. It was more than 100 tons of the stuff all in this warehouse on the edge of Tijuana. And it was reported in some quarters of the press that all of this represented a blow against organized crime to the tune of about $500 million. It was nearly $500 million, some people said. And I thought about this and I thought, you know, can it really be that much? That's a huge amount of money because the drugs business is big enough, but it's not that big. And how could any cartel withstand a kind of defeat like that? So I looked into it a bit more and it turned out that the way that this calculation had been done was using retail prices in the States. I mean, they just figured a gram of marijuana in America might cost, you know, maybe about, say, $5 as a conservative estimate. And so 100 tons multiplied by that amount gives you this incredible total. But in fact, this is crazy. I mean, imagine if you did that with another product like, say, coffee, and you said, well, a cup of coffee in the States in Starbucks costs, what is it, $2 or $3 or something like that. And in that cup of coffee, you've got 1 or 2 grams of coffee granules. So that must mean that a kilo of coffee intercepted in Colombia is worth $2,000. And of course, it's not. I mean, we know that that's absurd. And the reason that coffee increases in price is because the value of coffee is in, let's say, if you have it in a cafe like Starbucks, it's in the fact that it's been served to you, it's in the fact that Starbucks has to pay rent on its premises, it has to transport it around the world, and so on. That's why it increases in value. And so it's just the same with a drug like cocaine or marijuana. In Mexico, that drug there in a warehouse, it has a value, but it's not worth anything like as much as it's worth on the streets in the United States. In fact, in Mexico, the wholesale price of cannabis or marijuana is much less. It's like $80 per kilo. So that stash, which supposedly was worth $500 million, was probably worth about maybe $10 million, which, you know, it's not nothing, but it's about 2% of the amount that people originally thought.
You say that the cartels have personnel and HR issues that are similar to the issues that legitimate businesses face, and that you've spoken to cartel leaders who sound like CEOs. Who have you spoken to?
Well, this was a guy that I had in mind in particular who I went to see in El Salvador. And he's a guy called Carlos Mojica Lechuga, who is the leader of one of the two big street gangs in El Salvador. There are two of them, one called Barrio 18, or the 18th Street Gang, as most people call it in English, and the other called the Mara Salvatrucha. And both of these are effectively transnational corporations, really. I mean, they make their livings dealing drugs and with extortion, principally. Those are the two main business lines that they have. And so I thought it would be interesting to go and speak to this guy and find out how he ran his company. So I went to see him, and he's in jail at the moment, which doesn't seem to be stopping him from running his businesses in any way. So I went to see him in this prison in El Salvador. And apparently, by the standards of El Salvador, this is classified as a medium security prison, but it didn't look like one. I mean, outside you had soldiers with machine guns behind nests of sandbags. And anyway, I went in there and handed over my telephone and all the rest of it and went in, and they brought this guy in. And he's, just to describe him, you may have seen pictures of these El Salvador gangsters. They're the ones who very often have tattoos from literally from head to toe. And sure enough, this guy, Carlos, had a great big tattoo going across his forehead saying in Spanish, "In memory of my mother." And all over his body, he had these tattoos with the number 18 featuring prominently, which was the name of his gang. And so we sat down and we started talking business, and it really turned out that a lot of his complaints were just like the kind of complaints that I'd heard many times before from other business people. He complained about managing his staff, he complained about competition with his rivals, he complained about, you know, his image in the international media. It was really strangely reminiscent of speaking to a kind of frustrated mid-level manager. And sure enough, the kind of tactics that his gang is employing are not so different from the ones that other firms employ. And when I was there, the main sort of business strategy that he was experimenting with was a temporary truce, a kind of collusion with his arch rivals, this other gang, the Mara Salvatrucha that I mentioned. And the two gangs had decided at the time to stop murdering each other, which they'd been doing a lot, because they thought it would be better for business. And it had the most incredible effect. I mean, San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador, at one point was the world's most murderous city. And after the gangs signed this truce and decided to collude, the murder rate fell by about 2/3 overnight. And it was, by that stage, it was lower than in some cities in the States.
So it's dangerous to write about the drug wars because a lot of the cartels attack journalists. There's so many journalists who've been murdered. I think that's particularly true in Mexico. So did you feel like you were taking a risk to speak to this guy who's tattooed from head to foot and is a cartel leader. He's in prison, but he's still running the cartel. Did you feel like that put you at risk?
Well, I felt kind of nervous, to say the least. Yeah, I mean, I went into the prison and, you know, they showed me into this cell and they took the guy in and took off his handcuffs and shut the door behind us, and we were the only two in there. So I was kind of nervous about that. That meeting turned out fine, and in the end, actually, he was kind of intrigued by my line of questioning. I think he wasn't really used to being interviewed as though he were a businessman, and by the end he was telling me all about his admiration for the criminal gangs of East London, who he told me he'd always greatly admired as fellow entrepreneurs. But I think in terms of the threat to journalists, it's very real, but it's worth just making clear that really the journalists who undergo the really serious risks are the Mexican journalists. I mean, those are the men and women who have been killed in horrible numbers in recent years. In the past decade, more than 60 journalists have been murdered in Mexico. And really, it's the Mexican journalists that bear the brunt of this, partly because I think the level of impunity for murdering a local journalist is greater than it would be for murdering a foreign one, and also because it's often the local journalists that do the kinds of stories that hurt the cartels most. They're the ones that name the local police officers and the local politicians who are involved in corruption on a very local level, whereas the foreign journalists like me on the whole tend to do kind of bigger picture stories, which are perhaps less in danger of naming and shaming kind of local people on a very, very sort of micro level.
Well, Tom Wainwright, thank you for your reporting and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Tom Wainwright's new book is called Narconomics. He spoke with Terry last Monday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.